accession number 11256, reel 3.
Mr. Turner, reel 3.
Along with the food parcels, they also sent us British uniforms. Now, we were issued with a new uniform, and best of all, a pair of British boots. Once we got ourselves organised, we were still off out on the working party. And now, dressed as British soldiers, we marched through the streets. Now, it's the policy, apparently, of the Red Cross that you always salute the officers of the opposite units. So we had to salute German officers. As a corporal, I was in charge of the section. As we marched through the street, as we came to a German officer, I called him all to attention and gave him a snappy salute. They began to get a bit fed up with this. They made it quite clear that there was too much saluting going on. Anyway, eventually, still working at the waterworks, they decided that they would build a separate unit to save us going backwards and forwards to the camp. In other words, we were going to live on the job. And we became part of an Arbeitskommando. We did quite a number of jobs there. Nothing we could do about it. There was nothing to do with the military. And then one day they said that we had to lay a pipe from the waterworks to the Focke Wulf Works aircraft factory. Anyway, we dug the trench, and then we had to go down to the docks, to the railway yard, to collect the pipes. Now, the pipes were all clay pipes. I suppose they must have been 12, 14 inch in diameter. And we loaded these onto lorries. Now, the first lorry, we unloaded them, pulling them from the back and then stacking them in the yard. We then decided that if we unloaded from the side, we could unload them quicker. Then we talked the guard into agreeing. When we went down to the railway yard, we didn't put any chocks underneath the pipes. In consequence, when it got back to the waterworks, we got the guard to drop the side of the truck and the pipes rolled out. And they rolled onto the ones that we'd already stacked, and we reckoned that was about 70% of the pipes were smashed to pieces. So we did our little bit.
Did you get punished for it?
No. We managed to get away with it. We hadn't taken them off the truck. I mean, they just rolled off the truck. It's up to the guard. I think I've got an idea he was taken to task, but no, we weren't punished. Now, the trenches that we dug for these pipes, it was extremely sandy soil. And we had to strengthen them with wooden posts. We had an engineer amongst us, and somehow or other he'd worked out a scheme whereby once the trenches had been dug, by knocking out one of these posts, the trenches would collapse. We laid in two pipes, two or three pipes. Then we leaded them all up. And then gave the nod. One slight kick, and the the whole trench, and we watched them just collapse one after the other. So all the effort was to no avail.
Who organised that?
I was the corporal in charge of the unit, but it was an engineer in civil life, and he worked out some scheme. I don't know how he did it, mind you, but it was just, you know how they do these dominoes? It was something similar to that. And as they had one bit collapsed, and it was that all the way along the line, we just watched the whole lot collapse. At this particular time, I'd developed a toothache, and I decided that I'd had enough. And I went back to the main camp. I went into Graz, and I had the tooth out. And when I got back to the main camp, I said that I'd had enough. I wasn't going back to the waterworks. I wanted to go to an NCO's camp. And the NCO's camp was at a place called Spital. It's in Austria.
How do you spell that?
SPITTAL AN DRAU. Spital am Drau. Spital on the Drau. And say it was there. Was there for some months until 1943, when the Italian campaign collapsed, and they brought all the officers in the northern, from the northern part of Italy, into Spital am Drau.
You mean Italians?
No, British officers. The Germans had got camps actually in northern Italy. And all the camps in northern Italy were hurriedly pushed into Austria because the British troops were obviously advancing into the northern parts of Italy.
What was this camp at Spital am Drau like as compared with Maribor?
Oh, it was a large open camp. Say Maribor was a cavalry barracks. The camp at Spital was an open camp. It was right underneath the foot of the mountains, the Grossglockner mountains.
Did the camp have a number?
18B.
So Maribor was 18A.
Maribor was 18A. And Spital was 18B. That was an NCO's log, and you had to be an NCO to get in there.
So you preferred it in Spital?
Well, I didn't have to work there. Oh yes, it was easier going than working in the from Maribor. Now it was at that particular camp that I changed my identity.
Why did you do that?
The officers wanted to escape. Now, it was hopeless my trying to escape. I had no German language, no nothing, no idea where to go, what to do. And I must say, at this particular stage, which I've learnt when I changed over, the British ranks, corporals and even sergeants, were never given any instruction as to what to do in order to escape. They were never given any indication as to where to find maps or compasses or where they could get help outside. Now, I found out, of course, since, that the RAF were given all this information. The officers were given this information. They were told where to contact people outside. And, strangely enough, quite a lot of the bits and pieces that were required were passed through into prison camps through the Red Cross.
Through the parcels.
For instance, there was a map on a silk scarf. Means by way, methods of making compasses. Now, there's quite a lot of this information in one of the books there. There's quite a lot of information there. There's a lot of this information also at the Royal Air Force Museum at Hendon.
Did you feel that you should have been given more help?
I feel that we should have been, but I've summed it up, and I realise that it was virtually impossible to tell everybody where they could make contact outside.
So whose identity did you assume?
Now, I assumed the identity of a Flight Lieutenant Rex Reynolds.
Was he one of the ones that had come from Italy?
He was one of the men who come from Italy. And by what I gather, he was a bad boy. He was always escaping. He was a fighter pilot, a journalist for the Johannesburg Sunday Times. He was a lot bigger than me. Didn't look anything like me. I gather that he had a knowledge of some languages. Now, he did speak Afrikaans, which is very similar to German, and it's quite possible that that helped him to escape. Now, I had a letter from him early on, when we came back home, and it appears that he escaped and he spent quite a lot of time with the partisans. He eventually went to Buckingham Palace and he got the MBE.
Did you suffer any consequences during this transfer of identity?
No, I got away with it right till the end. I held his rank, his number, his wife, everything that I could possibly work out as far as Flight Lieutenant Reynolds was concerned, his name, Rex, and everything else, and I was accepted by the rest of the officers as Rex Reynolds, and we went up to Stalag Luft 3, which is the camp of the wooden horse and the big tunnel escape. And I managed to hold that rank right until the end of the war when I came back home.
So when the Russian advance came into Poland and you were in Stalag Luft 3, did you stay in the camp, or were you marched westwards?
No, we were at Stalag Luft 3. I've got dates in there. The evacuation of Stalag Luft 3, Sagan, January the 26th, 1945, at 23:30 hours. Orders to prepare to move. German radio announced the crossing of the Oder by the Russians in force on a 120-mile front. Orders to stand down on a 15-minute notice. Then at 3 o'clock, had a brew and went to bed. At 0:40:30 hours, we were told to fall in, fully equipped, each man issued with a Red Cross parcel on his way through the forelager. In the various billets, many thousands of cigarettes had been soaked in water and made unusable. Can you imagine 1,000 Kriegers, equipped with homemade packs and water bottles, carrying boxes, hauling sledges of every conceivable shape, upturned tables, backs of bent chairs, coal boxes, and here and there a pucker job made from bedboards or Canadian Red Cross crates? At 1,000 hours, we started to move. The guards seemed eager to move, and after the first few kilometres, they had mingled with the Kriegers, laughing and joking as if they had known each other for years.
Without going into the details of your march westwards, where did you eventually end up when you were liberated?
We eventually landed up at a place called Luckenwalde. That is 33 miles southwest of Berlin.
And who liberated you there?
Russians.
Can you describe what happened when you were liberated?
Here we are. April the 20th, 1945, was a Friday. The SBO informed that the Russians are 15 miles away, east and 20 miles northeast of Luckenwalde. And he told us that he does not believe it, but puts a defence scheme on half-hour notice. Gunfire all around the camp. German guards deserted the camp at 1300 hours. At 700 hours, a Russian recce tank entered the camp. Loud cheers. Then General Otto Ruge, he was the CNC of the Norwegian forces, and an SOS and a senior British officer aboard, moved out of the camp. At 0900 hours, part of an armoured spear arrived in camp. Five large tanks and several motor trucks. The Russian prisoners of war left the camp shortly afterwards. It was reported that General Ruge had been flown to Marshal Konev's headquarters on the evening, and in the evening the SBO met the Russian town major, who told him that we are to remain in camp until the Russians and American forces link up. Meat flowed into the stores. The Russians had even sent in live cows. At 0300 hours, we were strafed by an Focke-Wulf 109, but there were no casualties. It was reported that the Spearhead, which arrived here on Sunday, are now fighting in the outskirts of Potsdam. Food was still flowing in. We were issued with half a Canadian Red Cross parcel. On April the 28th, Saturday, I went out for a walk on my own. Strolling down a country lane, I was stopped by 9 armed Germans. One was wounded, and I asked them to return to the camp with me to get treatment for the wounded soldier. The Unter officer thanked me, saluted me, and went on my way in a southwesterly direction. Later on, a Russian repatriation commission arrived, and he brought with him 50 food lorries, 20 women interpreters, who referred to the camp as a place where the eagles live when visiting the RAF block.
Lieutenant, meaning the RAF personnel?
Yeah. Large-scale mopping-up activities began. The camp fairly rocked as shells and bombs burst in the vicinity. Lieutenant Colonel of the 84th American Division arrived today to make arrangements for the evacuation of British, American and Norwegian personnel. I was chosen for the first party to leave. The BBC London reported that Luckenwalde had been liberated. On May the 5th, ambulance arrived and departed with the sick. On May the 6th, part of a convoy arrived. The Russians refused to allow us to leave camp. American enlisted men who had left the camp lager were turned back. Russian guards were armed with Tommy guns. The SBO made a strong protest, and Captain Nebvedev, he was a Russian liaison officer, admitted to the hospital suffering from a nervous breakdown. 100 trucks arrived, but the Russians still maintained that we must wait for official orders from Russian headquarters. Everyone was cursing the Russian red tape. Then on May the 19th, great news, we were moving tomorrow. And we embarked on our journey home on May the 20th, and the route was Treuenbritzen, Coswick and Halle. We transferred from Russian trucks to American trucks at the Cossack Bridgehead, and then on to the 134th Evacuation Hospital, American. The cause of the delay was apparently a dispute concerning the number of Russian ex-prisoners of war to be exchanged for British, American and Norwegian in exchange for a rate of 10 Russians against one Allied. That was agreed and the exchange took place on the bridge. On May the 21st, at 1:30 in the morning, I slept on a spring bed for the first time in 4 years.
Did you see any of the Russian prisoners who were being exchanged?
Oh yes, yes, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them.
Did they seem happy to be going back?
Not very. Not very.
What made you think that?
I don't know. It's very difficult to put any indication on a Russian face. The majority of them, as I feel, were Mongols. They never smiled. They had nothing to smile about. I mean, they were treated very, very, very badly.
In what way?
They were virtually starved to death. No doubt about it. Absolutely no doubt about it at all. In that camp at Marburg, they had some Russian prisoners there. They used to line up for bread in the morning. And they used to up 9 at a time. And any Russian that had died, they used to carry him round in order to get his ration of bread. Now, I saw one Russian. He got so thin that the skin on his arms had virtually come over his elbow and he looked like a pair of wings. That's how thin he was. But we were burying Russians right, left and centre every day.
So why then weren't the Russians glad to be going back?
I have no idea. I should have thought they would have been happy, but I gather there was... it was something to do with Churchill, wasn't it? A lot of these Russians, they went back and they were virtually murdered afterwards. Apparently the Russian Iraqi didn't believe in people being prisoners of war. They should have died on the spot, by what I could gather.